podcast called Lockup Lowdown. The goal of this podcast is to provide listeners with information pertaining to all aspects of corrections, one issue or one topic at a time. I'm your host, DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. Today we're going to talk about COVID-19 and how it impacted and was handled by SCI Huntington officials. We are joined by Regional Deputy Secretary Tammy Ferguson, Joel Kohler, who is the Deputy Superintendent for Facility Management at SCI Huntington, and Scott Walters, who recently retired after 30.6 years. He finally left as a Deputy Superintendent for Centralized Services at SCI Huntington. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
So let's get to the details of how COVID-19 affected your facility. Up until you experienced COVID at your prison, you probably saw a lot of emails and video conference phone calls that were happening at the department's central office level and how SCI Phoenix, which is in Montgomery County, experienced the virus. They were the first institution to actually have the virus present itself in our system. Did you ever think that your facility would be impacted by it? And when and how did you first discover that you had COVID-19 at your prison?
This is Scott Walters. I'll respond to that first. The Department of Corrections did a pretty good job of getting us prepared and looking forward back as far as March. Mm-hmm. We ran some tabletop drills, and so COVID-19 was definitely on our radar screen, but it was one of those things that you plan for it, and you never hope that it shows up on your doorstep, but it did. So our second part of that question, the first time we discovered it, we had a chaplain, a contract chaplain, who serviced several SCIs across the state of Pennsylvania, and he came to work sick, and he didn't leave the office that day, the chaplain's office. So, you know, it got progressively worse, and we sent him home, and he got tested, and then the chaplain, our regular, actually he was the acting chaplaincy department head, he sat in the office with him that day, and then he got sick. So, I mean, obviously it's all speculation, but we think that that was how COVID entered SCI Huntington.
Wow. So how quickly after the two of them were sitting in the office together did the chaplain, the second individual, actually come down with symptoms? Like days?
It was several days. We were waiting for the contract chaplain's test results to come back. And the acting chaplaincy department head, he got sick, so we kind of suspected. However, also, and Bill Kohler can attest to this, in the interim, we had a Ramadan planning meeting in my office, and there was just about every administrator, and we had the food service manager. Everyone was packed in my office to plan for Ramadan. And then once we found out the chaplain had it, we were kind of like, uh-oh. And we knew we had a problem.
So when you were all packed in your office like that, were you all wearing masks at that point and trying to social distance in a small area? Or were you unmasked and just kind of sitting there amongst each other?
No, we were all masked. And I mean, my office was pretty good size, but it was just the thought of it. Okay, someone tested positive for COVID. Up until that point, it was all on TV or somebody else's issue. But when it hit home, I know Joel and I started discussing it. Joel was sitting right across from me, and we just kind of shook our heads and hoped for the best.
Okay, and then talk about when, like, it seemed like wow, once you had it, it really just kind of spread, which is what the Department of Health's secretary has always said, that it spreads exponentially. So you may have one or two cases today, and then a couple days later, you have like 10. So did you start to experience mass employee call-offs? And were the employees impacted first more so than the inmates? Tell me how that worked out.
This is Joel. Listen, I think from my recollection of this and going back through some of the records, I honestly think you're exactly on it. We had a few that were not feeling, staff members that were not feeling well and would call off, and we started monitoring it pretty hard there at first before a lot of direction came out. And then it grew into where it was almost simultaneous between the inmates and the staff. We would get one here, one call off there, and it was kind of slow in the very beginning, but then within a matter of maybe 2 weeks, it just felt like it absolutely exploded on us. We were getting mass cases to where we didn't know where we were going to go from day to day.
That must have been terrifying.
Scott, again, Joel talked about it a little bit, but we did monitor the records, and you know, in the lead up to this, and even during the heat of it, our call offs were really relatively low. I mean, the staff were so dedicated; they knew they had to come to work, and so we were not surprised, because we have a great staff at SCI Huntington, but it just reminded us of the work ethic they had. They weren't calling off. I mean, there was no call offs to, you know, for for issues that weren't really pertaining to COVID. If they were calling off, they were sick.
Right. And so also, can you talk a little bit about how the central office at the DOC actually prior to that started the enhanced employee screening? So even though your employees were very dedicated, if any came and had any kind of symptoms, you wouldn't let them in, obviously. So tell me about that process a little bit.
That actually began. Go ahead, Scott.
I'll let Joel answer that. What we started with, when we were directed to take the employee temperatures, we are fortunate to have two DOC staff, and we assigned one of those dentists, and he was willing to alter his hours to be, we positioned him in the outside visiting room, which is outside the walls of SCI Huntington.
Let me stop you there for a second. I just want to explain to people what a DATS is. It's a drug and alcohol treatment specialist, so it's an employee classification.
Sorry, Sue, that's dentist.
Oh,
a dentist.
Oh, I thought you said a DATS. Okay, dentist.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, so he was, you know, obviously well-trained in medical and was willing to alter his hours, and we placed him out there initially, and I'll let Joel talk about what else we did. So he was out there 5 days a week and started at 5:30, which caught the bulk of our shifts coming in the door, all the, you know, 8 to 5 or 8 to 4, 9 to 5, 52 staff. So he discovered a few. I mean, we screened employees and caught them before they come in if they had fevers.
So I'm just curious about him. Did he ever come down with COVID? Since he would have been involved and exposed to individuals probably more than anybody else, if he was doing temperature checks on everybody that was reporting to work, did he ever catch COVID?
No, ma'am.
He did not. Here's an interesting fact about that particular dentist. He has some other health issues and had been prescribed hydroxychloroquine. So he was taking hydroxychloroquine for another medical issue, and he felt confident that he was in the best position to be taking everyone's temperature. The guy's got a great attitude and really pitched in, and Joel can attest to that. And he was out there day in, day out. And I can't remember the last day when that man took a day off.
Wow. Joel, what do you have to say about that?
Scott's right on it. As far as the dentist himself, he just checked me in this morning. He's still out there swinging away at it. Hasn't lightened up at all. Man reports every day. I mean, you can't say enough good things about this guy.
Wow.
We were actually, the screening process was implemented there in the first week or so of March for us. And it was March 17th when we had our first staff turnaways. And there was three that particular day that we turned away for higher temps.
Mm.
One of them ultimately ended up, did result into a positive. The other two were negatives, but that's when it really started touching base with us. And most of, like we talked about earlier with our call-offs, a lot of them weren't call-offs. A lot of them were guys that came to work because they were trying to do their jobs and doing the right thing, and then we turned them away because of high temps or other factors. But so it just slowly progressed, and even finding the right spot. We were fortunate in the spot we have outside in our outside busy room that it worked out well for us. We weren't out in the weather, so we didn't have a lot of those mitigating factors. So we actually did very well as far as that.
Were those
in line with that? We also
go ahead.
We also implemented and we attached out front of our jail a hand washing station so that prior to staff even coming into the facility, once they got screened, as long as they passed, we posted an officer out there, and everybody was required to wash their hands and do all that kind of thing. So we took a lot of steps right from the beginning to try to stop this as it went.
Mm-hmm.
It did just get a hold of us. So
knowing that a lot of cases or individuals can be asymptomatic, when you talk about those first three, were they surprised? Like, did they have any idea that they had a fever?
No.
Okay.
One did, if memory recalls right, one did. But didn't think it was that bad. He thought he had the heat on his vehicle on coming in that morning. It was a cooler morning. He just thought it was due to that. Wasn't feeling ill, just knew he was hot coming in. Said he actually told me he took his hat off walking in because he wanted to cool off. So
wow. So talk to me about what happens when you turn an employee away. You know, that the testing and if there's any quarantining involved.
So that direction was given out, and it changed a couple of different times through the process of this whole thing, but there was a packet of information that we would give to them, and we would require them to basically be seen by their doctor prior to them coming back, and if their doctor felt that they needed to be tested or screened, that kind of information. But for us here at the institution, it was a matter of handing them the packet, informing them we weren't going to allow them in the jail that particular day until we got confirmation that they were free and clear of the COVID.
Okay. And so talk to me then about how quickly it started to spread among the staff and the inmates and how that impacted, your staffing.
Well, for staffing for us, and I think Scott and I are, we were the guys that kind of felt like we were the ones behind the eight ball all the time through this whole thing. It didn't matter what we did to mitigate. It just kept growing and growing. And I think we all fooled ourselves for a while there thinking we had it. We got ahead of this. We got ahead of that. We were doing well. And then it just already, it was so deep and so spread that we were behind the eight ball. As far as the staff goes, like Scott said, the work ethic here at Huntington is unbelievable. I mean, and this was evidence enough as we get out through this podcast to talk about some of these different things. What the staff here was able to do was double-edged. I mean, part of the chaplain, the original our chaplain, that contracted the first positive employee case here, we had him working in our dining hall with all of our staff. All of our staff were down there feeding out trays and moving through, and he was right there beside him for weeks, or for at least a week or so, until he started really coming down with symptoms and then went out to get tested himself. But our own work ethic actually played against us a little bit in the beginning of it. So
yeah. And so talk about also how your prison's architecture might have led to the difficulty of containing the virus. And like, the prison opened in 1889. And tell me about the construction, the architecture of the prison.
Well, I think from my seat, that one of the biggest things is the open cell doors. We still have barred cell doors here. So it's all open air here and everywhere you go. They're in prototypicals. You have solid doors that help stop the spread in some aspects, but here we're wide open everywhere we go. So.
And you also have multiple tiers. So you have cell blocks, just like in the old movies that people would see. So, but you have four tiers, or is it five?
We have four on one of our blocks and three on most of them, yeah.
Okay. And then they all have open, like you said, the open bar doors. Yep. So how many inmates are on average on each of the cell blocks at the beginning of this?
Yeah, they vary. Okay, so each block's a little different. You have some blocks upwards of 300 on a block. You have other blocks that are upwards of 400. So
wow. And prior to this system being locked down, the movement through your facility is everybody goes through like a central rotunda from the cell blocks to get to, you know, the dining hall and to the correctional industries jobs inside the institution. So at some point they're all like passing each other possibly. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, ma'am.
Wow.
That's in normal times. And Sue, I wanted to go back. This is Scott again for a second. And,
uh-huh.
You know, after looking at some of the questions in preparation for the podcast, you know, I think that our architecture of SDI Huntington, while we have open bars, it did enable us to be very flexible and make a lot of changes and shift on the fly to address and deal with this. If COVID struck a prototypical institution and not an older institution like Huntington, we had a lot of areas that we were able to put into action, make a few changes, and accomplish the goals. You know, we had inmates in special areas, and these, you know, we've made medical triage areas in certain areas and took over a couple classrooms.
Yeah.
And all of those things wouldn't have been available at a prototypical, but we were able to do it. And also, with all of our inmates passing through a single checkpoint, we still do it now, we're able to do temp checks before they get to work or get back to the areas, you know, as the institution opens up. So you can kind of screen them before you send them off to work or send them into the kitchen or out anywhere else because they're passing one centralized location. So I would say that overall, once COVID spread through SDI Huntington, and maybe the architecture worked against us, although we are fairly spread out. In the end, it helped us because, you know, an old institution like ours had a lot of areas that we could use as isolation areas, special areas to deal with the problem. So,
right.
In the end, the old battleship of SDI Huntington, you know, came through. And some of the things that people may see as, you know, a hindrance to us actually helped us to address the situation and separate inmates and utilize areas that we previously hadn't used, but they were able to be quickly, you know, put back into service.
Okay, so let's talk about that. So SCI Huntington does not have an infirmary, and as the inmates started to present with symptoms and needed to be cared for, you couldn't ship them to like Smithfield, which might have been your normal procedure was to send individuals who needed infirmary care from Huntington to Smithfield, correct? So how did you deal with that? Let's talk about the first transition of an area, which was your gym, and turning that into an isolation area. Talk about how that all came to be, who worked on it, who made it happen, and where you are today now.
So we, when we realized that we had to, Scott again, when we realized we had to create some infirmary areas, we had a lot of discussion, and Superintendent Kaufman, Deputy Kohler, and myself, we looked at everything we had. I mean, we considered getting mobile job trailers or temporary trailers to put in the exercise yard. I mean, we examined every single thing we had. And, you know, there was no template that we could go by because it was so new. You know, no one had been there. And I know
Superintendent Smith at Altsdale had set up some tents and gym there. So we got our hands, they sent us some pictures. So we modeled it after that. And, you know, we identified our gym. And, I mean, some of the considerations that folks don't think about when you're doing things like this is you need bathrooms, you need showers. There's a lot that comes into play. I mean, you need an area to keep your medical people. You know, the other thing is too, you couldn't forget that, you know, we're housing some dangerous people and they're inmates, and so we needed camera coverage, good security. But the thing is, and there was a lot more too. I mean, we had to find a place to put a washer or a dryer. We couldn't take the stuff out of there and wash it and dry it. We need to house these guys for a couple of weeks in a particular area. But the thing that we had to do, and I'll let Joel talk more about how great our maintenance department was, but we did not have the luxury of saying, all right, we have, you know, we can sit down and have a 3-month planning process for this. This was, you know, our small administrative team sitting in an office, hashing this out. When we had to come up with a plan and, in a very short amount of time, make it workable. And part of that, and I'll let Joel talk about that too, is we enlisted the help of other maintenance departments. And so, Joel, do you want to talk about how we put the all the cubes together in the gym?
Yeah, absolutely. So we reached out with the help of central office to other facilities to help us kind of makeshift build walls and get costs and all this stuff that's going to go into these things. The whole time, our maintenance department, we identified our gymnasium as our first major area. And our maintenance crew, within a matter of, correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, 72 hours, had the equipment from SCI Rockview and beds from other facilities, cots, mattresses, all this stuff coming to us. They were able to put together a 33-bed unit in the gym within 72 hours. It was unbelievable to watch.
Amazing.
And I mean, from a typical gymnasium basketball court to a full-on infirmary in less than 3 days was just mind-boggling, but it was the necessity that we needed at that time. But then as this thing progressed and grew, it became necessary to start looking at other avenues because we were fastly running out of those bed spaces as quick as we were putting them in.
Wow.
Now, in that, you also had triage areas for the nurses that you had to look at. Like Scott said, you had to have camera angles for PREA concerns, bathroom facilities, shower area facilities, donning and taking off of the PPEs for the staff members when they enter and exit the areas. All this stuff had to play a count and all had a factor in how we built this and where we built this. Well, then it got to the point where, oh my God, we got to move into a different area. And we would no sooner get another area identified, maintenance again would go to work on that. And it took next to no time. Now, as this thing wore on, it became evident we were wearing our people out. They were working long hours, long days, and then moving forward. So we did reach out, and RDS Ferguson and all of the whole team down there was able to get us more maintenance crews from other institutions. And all these guys, I mean, fit in here and ran in here, and we're staffing that way for as far as the maintenance goes. It was unbelievable, but it shows what the Department of Corrections is all about. We run to the fires and not away from them, and that's what these people did. As they come in here, they knew we were in the data. They knew what they were getting into, and they still volunteered to come in here and help us. And
nice.
I think we identified, four areas that we made up, the B school, our TC community, the gym, and then above our kitchen in a warehouse area was the last area we built. And it was just
the mod.
Oh, yeah, and out in the mods, yeah.
So the mods are modular housing units that are outside the wall but still within a secure fenced area, correct?
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
So, wow. Yeah. And at one point, you must have had all those areas busy, popping with inmates.
We had two full areas that we completely filled up at least at one point, had full running. We actually never had to use the area above Kitchen, nor did we ever enter into the B school, but it was there. Now, we did use the mods. As we started transferring inmates out, that led into, we had to move people out of the TC community. So we were short on bed space in the house. And again, we reached out to RDS Ferguson and her team, and they were able to identify some help with SCI Force or Phoenix.
Right.
So we put together some numbers and some people, and the whole time, this is a fun fact with all this, the whole time that we were talking with central office and even locally here with the staff numbers we had out and the inmate numbers we had down, we just knew because of the jail that there was a ton more people out there that were infected that we weren't getting. They didn't want to go down to our isolation areas. They didn't want to do this, so the inmates were hiding symptoms from us and things of that nature. So when we identified this number of people, and I want to say it was somewhere around the 80 mark rate at first, inmates to be transferred out, that's when we implemented the mods, how we were going to do the mods. So then that number dwindled a little bit, but we tested each and every one of them, and dang near half of them come back as positive.
So let me...
I remember sitting here that day, uh-huh, getting the email on all these people, and I remember saying... writing an email to Scott, he was up in his office, said, oh my God, it was the real punch in the gut moment, the realization of how far this really looked for. So
let me just clarify for the listeners a little bit about what you were just talking about. So central office leaders decided that they really needed to help Huntington and kind of alleviate what was going on by removing some of the inmates from Huntington and sending them to Phoenix, or SCI Phoenix. Phoenix had a standalone self-contained unit that was to be used for female transitional purposes, but had never been opened. And so while you guys were dealing with what was going on at Huntington, Phoenix and other people from other parts of the DOC were brought in to ramp up operation of this a female transition unit to take approximately 100 of your inmates and move them there. And so, but before doing that, the direction was given that you need to test the identified inmates that would be transferred. And again, as you found, a large majority of those individuals were asymptomatic and positive. And so you had to, we moved the ones that we could that tested negative to the transition unit at Phoenix. And then you had to deal with the ones that were positive and you moved them to your outside service unit where you kind of quarantined them or isolated them until they were ready to be transferred. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So there was a lot going on. Not only were people coming to your aid to help you there, but also coming to your aid at Phoenix to help. And even though about 100 inmates ended up being moved, it still provided you with a little bit of breathing room that you needed.
Yes, absolutely. That's a fact.
And at the same time that all of this was going on, talk to me about the work that you were doing with the Bureau of Healthcare Services at Central Office. Like, you also had to reach out to the different emergency medical services and the hospitals in your area because you needed to talk about, their capabilities for dealing with inmates that would need transferred to hospitals. So tell me about all of that work that went on.
So initially, we have agreements with all of our local hospitals, and our healthcare administrator, she reached out to, there's a lot involved. We have a contract with a local ambulance service, which we thought we would obviously be utilizing heavily, and we did. And the local hospital in Huntington, Penn Highlands, of course, they're a basic care hospital. So we did a lot of business with them, and UPMC Altoona was really good with us. So it involved a lot of meetings, a lot of discussions, and on patient care and process how we were gonna deal with patients. And we shipped a good number to the hospital, but not as many as I thought we would.
Mm-hmm.
initially when we were doing some of the tabletop drills, I thought we would be to the point where we were going to overwhelm the local hospital or and local ambulance service, but it never got to that point. So we had great communication. The doctors at central office acted as liaisons for some of these bigger issues with the outside hospital administrators. And I know Joel dealt with some issues we had with our local ambulance service. I mean, there was a lot of uncertainty, but the hospital supported us, the community supported us, you know, the ambulance services did. You know, in hindsight, it worked out pretty good. I mean, we were nervous at first that, you know, we did not want to be overwhelming our local healthcare service, especially if COVID was ripping through the community. You know, mm-hmm. We didn't want to be taking up beds and, you know, pulling the ambulance into SCI Huntington if they were needed somewhere else. But, you know, it was a few minor bumps in the road, but I think we were all pretty pleased with how they dealt with us. You know, we had some patients at UPMC that were there for extended periods of time, and we had staff up there. And the other thing, too, we're talking about the hospitals. You know, staffing became an issue with us, and we, in discussion with central office, we got some assistance in manning those hospital posts with correction officers from other institutions. Specifically, Benner and Housedale helped us out. It was a real lifesaver.
Wow.
And I know later on when we had multiple patients in the hospital, Joel and some of the security staff reached out. And we attempted to house all of our patients in close proximity so that we, you know, we can maximize our correction officer and supervisory resources that we had up there. And they worked with us on that, too. So I would say that overall I was very happy with the support we got from the outside medical folks in Huntington and in Altoona at UPMC and Penn Highlands, plus our local ambulance division. So
excellent. What was COVID like in the community? Were people as sick as, you know, your employees and your inmates were at Huntington? Like, was the community experiencing it?
We talked about, you asked me about the first case in Huntington, and I explained that about the chaplain, but there was several others that, and obviously we did a lot of contact tracking, which is a process. Once someone tests positive, you backtrack to see who they may have had contact with. And we did a lot of that, and we used our camera systems, and we had officers working around the clock. And Joel enlisted, we had guys sitting right in the computer hub room. We hooked a monitor up there. You go in there at 11 o'clock at night, someone's, you know, tracking who may have had contact with a certain employee. So
wow, that's
so
amazing.
There's a lot of that going on. But getting back to the other issue is that we had a staff member that traveled overseas, and he went to a wedding or something in the Caribbean and passed through the Miami airport when COVID was ripping through there. He came back to work for one day and went out and got tested. This particular employee tested negative twice, but his wife tested positive, and they attended church service prior to realizing that either one of them may have had it. And so there was some community spread in a local church, and one of that particular church member got really ill. And so there was that could have been another way that he came into SCI Huntington, but there again, he tested negative twice, but missed a month's worth of work. And then we had another kitchen staff who his wife worked at a convenience store about three counties away, and that store got hit with COVID. So it could have came in that way. So those were the three potential sources, but at this point, you know, you never know.
Right.
So we looked at
at least three ways it came into FBI, Huntington, perhaps. But community, there was some cases, but I mean, it was minimal. And you look at the numbers on the Department of Health website, most of Huntington County's cases were ours, but, you know, we know the specific numbers, and there's some that weren't, but I don't think it, by and large, it didn't really affect the community of Huntington outside of FCI Huntington very deeply.
Wow. Just amazing to show how close quarters and close contact really does spread the virus, and how you can be asymptomatic for a while and still be spreading it. It's just amazing to me. And I think that, you know, luckily, knock on wood, there are a lot of our facilities in the rural areas and who just really haven't experienced any cases, thank goodness. And again, knock on wood. And so I think, you know, I hear a lot of people out in the public saying, ah, this isn't real. And I'm like, no, this is real. We've experienced it at two of our facilities and how quickly it can spread. And, you know, everybody needs to continue to wash their hands and social distance and wear their masks. But anyway, I digress. So let's talk about what it's like to deliver the services that the inmates need in their cells and how you and your dedicated staff did that. So we're talking, you know, in cell education and programming, you know, treatment programming and medical and mental health care and religious services. So can you talk a little bit about how, even though you were locked down and even though you were dealing with all of the COVID stuff and the isolation and the quarantine areas, how you delivered all these services that the inmates still needed to get?
Sure. So we did a lot of in-cell programming, and you know, we were running our coffee machines, you know, around the clock, making copies. As Joel alluded to earlier, we closed our drug and alcohol treatment dormitory down to turn it into an isolation area. So we had those inmates that we were still providing programming to. So our staff would use the mail system, and they would send the copies down of the program work. And also we used the inmate television channel that we have.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of programming that if we were running a particular group, we could let the inmates know that we were going to run that week's programming or lesson on channel 27.
Oh, nice.
So the inmates that had TVs, and a lot of them did have TVs, tuned in and were able to do some of the coursework there. And about a year ago, we installed a system in our chapel. We were having some issues. Now, our chapel's up five flight steps at FCI Huntington. It's at the very top of the institution. And we had some inmates that couldn't get there, and you know, so we moved some inmates out that have, you know, ones with disabilities who really wanted to go to the chapel. We would, you know, adhere to the ADA and send them to one or two level facility. But to service others, what we did about a year ago is we put a live system in. So we have a dedicated camera and an audio system in our chapel, so we can broadcast our religious services over live on channel 44. So the way that works is it has an on and off button. We'd have the security staff in the control center to turn it on, and the camera pops up live, and then there's an audio switch, so there's a microphone there, and we use that system heavily. Our chaplains did multi-denominational services, and we ran our regular Islamic services. Everything we had was run live, but there was no audience. It was all over television. Also, we used that system to address the inmates. I use that a lot to deliver messages, updates, weekly updates, status updates, that type of thing. So we used technology as much as we could to help us out. And our staff were all over the place with, you know, working to make sure inmates had programming that they needed for parole. I mean, the parole process never stopped. We had to keep
keep inmates moving. And so a lot of it was thinking outside the box because we'd never done anything like this before. A lot of the line staff had great ideas to come up with plans to, you know, address things. And there again, I think Joel will attest to it. We have a lot of smart people working for us, and they were able to troubleshoot. And we'd tell them what the task was, and if we wanted programming done or religious services done or something else delivered, we'd ask them, challenge them to what the task was, and get out of their way, they would do it. The last thing I'll add, Joel could talk about this monumental task, meal delivery.
Mm.
We have thousands of inmates that need meal delivery, and initially one of the challenges was getting styrofoam clamshells to deliver the meals. I mean, I had a hotline to the business manager's office. We were trying to source clamshells, styrofoam clamshells, all around the state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just initially there was a big rush when COVID hit, and there was a shortage. So, but we kept the wheels turning. And, so with that, I'll pass it off to Joel. He can talk for a minute about the monumental task that our staff do every day with these meal deliveries.
Yeah, there's no doubt that it was a task. They, like Scott said, you keep in mind we're sitting around 2,000 inmates, feeding them at least three times a day. It's just as crazy to think about with the staff that we had. But listen, again, the staffing here, we had clerks. There was not one department inside this facility that didn't step up and didn't help out in one way, shape, or form. And there's something to be said about that because not every place is like that.
Right.
They were able to produce these meals, get the meals made, get the meals served onto a tray, count it off, and push to different areas of the facility, and then hand deliver each meal three times a day for weeks and weeks and weeks on end.
Wow.
It was unbelievable to watch and to be part of. I mean, Scott and I were down there making meals and pushing trays and hand delivering trays just right alongside with them, just because everybody had to help out to make sure the job was getting done. And that was what we did.
I don't think people...
At one point we talked...
Go ahead.
At one point, we were talking about some of the staffing, and it wasn't just maintenance staff that came in. Central office was able to help us out. RDS Ferguson, Deputy Goodman, all of them get involved, and they were getting us other security staff to come in. And the last round of people that come in literally worked nowhere but that kitchen. They were in that kitchen all the time. I mean, the staff that were signed during those hours in that kitchen all the time. And I know we talked to them before they left, and some of them did, oh my God, I can't believe I've never worked in a kitchen so long in all my life. But that was where our absolute need was for the longest point in time.
Absolutely.
Ensuring we had the bodies to make sure it happened. So
amazing. I don't think a lot of people realize that under normal operations, we use inmates to work in our institutions, and they're supervised by, you know, the food service supervisors and instructors. But a majority of the time, it's the inmate workers that are actually doing all of this work. So, and, you know, you experience these lockdowns, you know, periodically, but not for this length of time. So kudos to everybody who came to your aid. I also wanted to just mention, thank you, Scott, for talking about all the programs that were delivered despite the lockdown, because I know I see on social media that there's a lot of individuals who are alleging that, you know, we're just locking the inmates away, and that just is not true. And like you said, the parole process continued. And so, you know, kudos again to all of your staff for keeping all of these programs running. And it's not only at Huntington, this was throughout the entire state prison system as well. The other thing I just wanted to talk about real quickly was, you know, just like people out in the community, inmates who have TVs are able to watch TV and news. And, you know, news coverage nowadays, it's very different. Like, you just don't know what is true. And so I would imagine if an individual like an inmate is locked in their cell and they're watching news all day long, it can be pretty scary. Like, they're not only worried about what's going on at Huntington, but they're also worried about their families out in the community, maybe in Philadelphia, which was, you know, pretty hit pretty hard by COVID. So how on earth did you help to keep the inmates calm? I would think that communication was the key here. Can you talk a little bit about how your staff communicated with the inmates about what was going on with COVID, not only in the facility, but in the communities? And did you use your certified peer specialists in that at all?
No, so we just recently, when we were locked down, there was, you know, obviously a heightened aware of not wanting people to move from one unit to another unit and this kind of thing, and we just didn't have people roaming around. We assigned certain staff to certain units, and they would work those units for weeks on end, with the exception of certain entities. But the inmates honestly deserve a real wound, because during the course of all of this, and you're absolutely right, you hit it on the head, watching the news, talking to family members through mail and through different things, even the little bit of phones, once we got phones up, it was scary for them. But we literally had a reduction in misconducts and any kind of extraordinary occurrences. The inmates were very, very well, behaved is the right terminology, sure. But they really, really stepped up, and they deserve a hearty thank you for not acting a fool basically during all of this. I mean, I don't know if that's the right terminology again. You might want to have your guy look at that. But the long and short of it was, you're absolutely right. Communication was the key all the way through this. And I think at some levels we failed at it in the beginning, because it was a matter of, there were so many moving parts and it was so fluid. The inmates would literally, in certain housing units, seen inmates going down to the gym in our isolation areas, and they called it C-Town. And down in C-Town, if you go to C-Town, you don't come back kind of thing, because we unfortunately did lose a few people to COVID. But that was the initial mindset. After we got going through a course of time and was able to sit back and, hey, we need to concentrate on the communication, be on the tiers, the staff did a phenomenal job. I can say that not only as the deputy or as the major, but as an employee that didn't work his entire career at Huntington. Coming to Huntington and seeing what the people do at Huntington coming from another facility is absolutely amazing to me daily, because these people step up 3 ways from Sunday. And like Scott said, there's a lot of quality people down there, a lot of smart brains walking around. You merely got to mention, hey, listen, we need to concentrate on doing this. And these people will take it upon themselves and they'll get it done. You don't have to repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And that's a big, big thing for us here. And that's really what helped us keep it going.
Nice. Can you just talk briefly about cohorts? So what is a cohort? And then, you know, letting the inmates out of their cells in cohorts for phones and showers. How did that work?
So as we got moving through this and putting in our plans of actions as we moved, I mean, there was a need to get guys showers, to get guys the opportunity to get on the phone and speak to family members, because they didn't know what was going on in their family, things of that nature. The cohorts is nothing more than a number. So the number that we stuck with for the longest was 10 inmates. 10 inmates made one cohort, and we depicted that down to the unit management teams. They designated them, and you would literally bring out those 10 guys, take them to the showers, allow them the chance to shower, take them to the phones, allow them to use the phones or the kiosks, whatever it be. So the cohort, and it sounds like the cohort's going to be with us for a long while here. Mm-hmm. We've recently, through our plans of actions, and we got approval here about a week ago to bump them up to 20. So now they're 20-man cohorts. And again, going way back to the beginning of this conversation, like Scott said, the tracking. That's still pretty vital, because if someone is asymptomatic and is infected and even doesn't realize it, he's infecting those 20 people. But now we know he's in that cohort group. So theoretically, with the exception of a few staff members that are doing escorts, the tracking purposes should be that much easier.
And containment as well, hopefully.
Yes, absolutely.
Wow. Amazing. So I know we're pushing an hour, so I just want to kind of quickly move through the rest of my questions, but there's so much to talk about, and I really appreciate you taking this time. So at what point did you begin to see cases slow? How many days, weeks were you suffering through this?
Because like an eternity.
Yeah, because now, you know, there was a point where, you know, daily emails were going out through DOC leadership, and I was seeing those, and it, you know, every day it was like, oh, it's growing, but then you peaked, and finally, you know, I must have given a huge sigh of relief. It was like, wow, they're coming out of this. I think they're coming out of this. So how long did that take?
Once we got into May, you know, and we were locked into the isolation time, and Joel and I would sit there and, you know, run the numbers with our list, just waiting for inmates to go through the doctor approved isolation period to move them out of the gym or wherever, or the dorm, whatever isolation area they were in. So we set short-term goals, and we'd be looking at those, and we'd obviously look forward and say, all right, well, here's the – when these guys will be expired, and they can move out. So we really didn't look too long-term, and we were working with the short-term to, mm-hmm. to try to find some positive in this. And, you know, there'd be days then, you know, the first couple cases started coming out of isolation. There was still inmates coming in, but then we knew that once, you know, if we isolated 25 inmates on one particular day, then in 2 weeks that we were going to get a big sense of relief. So, you know, Joel and I, and most of the administrative staff, I mean, we lived at FCI Huntington hour after hour, you know, early morning, late at night, you know, rubbing our foreheads, waiting for it to come to an end. And, you know, I look back now, and I think Joel will probably agree with me. You know, I really don't know where, you know, most of March, April, and May went.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't go anywhere. I didn't do anything. We didn't do anything except corrections work and go home. And then we would come home and watch the news like everyone else to see what else we could pick up and what else we could learn. So I agree with Joel. It felt like an eternity until the tide turned, and so time seems like it's slowing down, especially for me now, but I'm still following along with the emails here.
Right.
And we're down to just a couple in isolation now, so hopefully in the short term the tide has turned and the end is near, but I think we got to be ready for, you know, wave two if that ever comes.
Right.
Hopefully the vaccination comes first.
Right. So let's talk, unfortunately, about you did have several inmate deaths. And so a lot of people, tell me about those inmates without getting specific, like, were they old? Did they have underlying medical conditions, or did they just simply die of COVID? Like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So some of those inmates were with us for years and years and years. And they also fit the bill on exactly what the experts were telling us with pre-existing conditions, heart conditions, cancer survivors, diabetes. That was the only thing that COVID did that was predictable for us. I mean, there's no way to know, you know, what was going to happen. But initially, the doctors, CDC, Department of Health told us, look, these are vulnerable inmates. So we entered into a tracking system for all of our vulnerable inmates at Huntington, where we were doing wellness checks. The nurses were going by their cells and checking on them because they had pre-existing conditions.
Wow.
So, unfortunately, inmates that passed away did all have pre-existing conditions. One, I think the youngest was in his 50s, and he had some heart issues, and we had some in their 70s. And we had one particular guy who was in his 90s, and he recently passed away, but he had some pre-existing health conditions. And I think, Joel, he actually beat COVID. He got through the isolation period and passed away here recently.
Amazing. So the other thing I wanted to just mention was, now that you're starting to return to some sort of normal, What's going to happen to all those various areas that you built, the isolation and quarantine areas? Are you going to keep them? I mean, now that you're probably going to kind of let the cohort groups out, don't you need to use your gym? So what's the plan with that area?
Yeah, so in, like we talked about here, you know, and whatever the conventional wisdom is on a second round in the fall or not, it would be absolutely reckless of us to just dismantle all of them and go back to business as usual. We'll keep a few on hand that we need to. A couple of the areas we'll keep, and maybe an area like the gym that we do utilize for recreation, especially during summer months, might be the best area to dismantle for now and keep other ones in place. But we won't get rid of all of them altogether.
Right. And now the Department of Corrections and the leaders and all the facilities are looking at trying to figure out what the new norm is amid COVID, because COVID is definitely here to stay and is something that we're definitely going to have to deal with moving forward. It's just going to be amazing to see what the new norm is, and that's something we're still developing. So as you kind of move forward and you kind of get this opportunity to take a breath, what are some of the major takeaways that you've learned from dealing with COVID, and what, if anything, would you have done differently?
Well, listen, at least from my seat, and I know Scott and I've talked about this 100 times. There's a, you know, the hindsight's always 20/20, mm-hmm. and there's things that you could have and should have, and that kind of thing. But for me, I think, when I try to rationalize, like anybody else, throughout our careers, most of our threats are either that of physical or whatever, but they're in front of you. You can see them. With a disease like this, you can't see it. You don't know where it is. To try to isolate it and say, oh, listen, do this and that'll fix it forever, isn't the value. You got to kind of keep that open mind and, like Scott said, adapting to what our physical layout was here and how we move forward on that is, again, being ever vigilant. I mean, I don't know that we'll ever go back to a nonchalant-type block cleaning the way they used to be. I mean, Decon 7 is a part of our life right now, and
yeah,
will stay a part of our life, I'm sure, for months and months and months to come.
Right.
High touch points became a word in the vocabulary that I never really gave a whole lot of thought to until here recently. So moving forward, I think keeping that kind of stuff in perspective is what it is. But again, for me, the sheer amazement of this staff here, I don't know that, and I don't want to say this because this sounds ignorant, but I don't know that any other jail could have done what these people did here. This was absolutely amazing to be part of, and to even sit back and watch in some avenues what the people at SCI Huntington were able to accomplish as a team, not as any one person. Like I said earlier, every entity did something to help get us through this thing. And then there was all the volunteers that come in to help us, all the people at central office and all their knowledge and wisdom coming down to us and thought processes coming to us. I mean, this was a collaborated effort for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people to help get us through this thing. So
amazing. Amazing. Yes. Congratulations to you and your staff. Scott, did you have any final thoughts that you wanted to share?
I did. I wanted to tell the listeners that throughout this, our main goal was obviously keeping everyone safe, the staff and the inmates, and, you know, housing the inmates appropriately. And, you know, for any inmate families that may listen to this, you know, this entire process, with everything that we did, we focused on keeping the inmates safe and housing them appropriately and you know, making their life as comfortable as it could be while you were incarcerated. I mean, when you're incarcerated, a lot's taken away from you. And this COVID caused us to slow down and keep inmates in cells. And, you know, we reiterated this to the inmates constantly, that they didn't do anything wrong. This was just a situation that we needed to deal with. And
mm-hmm.
It's during the process, Joel and I fielded dozens of calls from inmate families, and we tried to explain that to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so we wanted to get through this with, you know,
the smallest amount of casualties as we possibly could, staff and inmates. Keeping them all safe was job one for us and was our complete focus. And we may not have got some things right, but we got a lot right. And we minimized our casualties. And so that would be my final takeaway from it, is that throughout the process, that was our number one goal. And that's what Joel and I tried to get through to the staff, to keep them safe, keep everyone wearing their masks and washing their hands. And we sounded like a broken record when we put out a message to that, but it was important.
Yes, so absolutely.
That was what I would like to say.
Great, thank you. Now, Deputy Tammy Ferguson, are you still on the line? I just wanted to give you an opportunity to say anything that you wanted to share and to kind of wrap everything up before I go into my closing remarks.
So, I mean, I sit and I listen to these two just remarkable leaders speak on this entire experience and how that translated and sort of evolved at Huntington, how the strategies that were in place at other facilities, how the physical plant of Huntington became our biggest challenge, and how we had to try to overcome those things and introduce different strategies to try to put Huntington in the best possible position. But, you know, I think that what has also been translated throughout this conversation is that this was an exceptionally difficult challenge for us. And Huntington, in a typical historic Huntington fashion, showed leadership, resilience, perseverance at all levels of staff classifications. You know, you have two phenomenal leaders. You have Superintendent Kaufman, just a phenomenal team, an inmate community that rallies with their staff to try to achieve the same goals for the facility. And Huntington is very proud. And what Huntington would typically do, Huntington would be the jail that is always there to raise their hand to help any other facility throughout the Commonwealth. And in this case, it was Huntington that needed the assistance. And what we saw was that historic, really truly commitment to the agency that Huntington has showed us in their long historic years. They were the recipients of other facilities that stepped in recognition of the challenge that was being felt at Huntington, for all the things that Huntington had always historically done to assist the rest of the agency. And from our position and being able to help Huntington try to identify their needs, get them the resources, whether it be staff, whether it be movement of inmates, whether it be trying to address what, you know, they had both conveyed, sometimes communication issues, watching, you know, them try to develop through those, through things like HNT and putting additional officers on the ground, utilizing the Bureau of Investigation Intelligence to try to get on the phone and listen to what the inmate complaints were and come back and surround that, rally around it so that their individual issues were being identified. And it was really, truly, despite the very unfortunate circumstances at Huntington, it was amazing to see this team rally to do what they did. I had a few short days, and certainly what Scott had said about the commitment and the time that staff had inside the facility throughout this entire occurrence. I had opportunities to enter Huntington during this time frame, and you could not walk into Huntington and not become emotionally impacted by what was occurring inside that facility at that time. When you would see the staff movement trying to do what they are charged to do, which is ensure for the safety and security of those inmates, and how that team rally with each other, with these different entities that came to their assistance. And in unison, in typical Huntington fashion, with exceptional leadership at all levels, they saw us through one of the most difficult times in the department's history.
Yeah.
And that is a credit to that team.
Thank you. You know, I, from the beginning of COVID, the theme was, we're all in this together. And I think that certainly has been proven with the experiences at Huntington. So it's the staff, it's the inmates, it's the community, the hospitals and the EMS and everything. We truly are all in this together. So, you know, I really want to just express how proud I am of everybody at Huntington and everybody who came to Huntington's aid. Kudos to everybody during a difficult time and the scrambling that they did to, you know, really kind of contain what was going on there. So congratulations to everybody. Special congratulations to Scott, who is retiring after 30.6 years of service with the Department of Corrections. Kudos to Huntington staff and inmates for getting through this. And, you know, this may not be the end. We all have to stay vigilant because we could see, you know, cases pop up here and there, but what a great experience. I'm so thankful that all of you have been able to take some time out of your very busy schedules to participate in this podcast. I think it's important for listeners to understand everything that everybody went through. So I want to, again, thank you for participating. And listeners, please don't forget that you can always learn more about the Department of Corrections by visiting the website, which is www.cor.pa.gov. That concludes this episode of Lockup Lowdown. We'll see you next time. Thanks.